Thanks to everyone for coming to the last of our series on Jews and politics. There's a few announcements. The next series will probably be September 5th and 12th, a two-part mini-series before Rosh Hashanah at Beth Emeth by Rabbi Churchiner on issues related to Rosh Hashanah in advance of the holidays. And as I mentioned to a few people, Moish kindly brought over a box of books as he was clearing out his house. You're free to look at them afterwards. I see some people have taken. The members of the Kol have already enjoyed many of the gifts from Moish, so we have now looked through it, and my bookshelf is now even more stacked than it was before. And the last thing is there is the list of people who registered over there. If you want, I'll send out one final email with the sources and the link to the recording from this class. If your name isn't there, your email isn't there, the sign-up sheet will be going around. Okay. So the topic I thought we'd deal with for our last week, for the last 3 weeks, we've dealt mostly with, I don't know what you call them, domestic politics of Jews, right? Jews as members of democratic society, how they vote, how Jews relate to taxation, how Jews relate to how Jews should lobby. But one of the things that at this point Israel is most famous for on the political scene is actually its interaction with the world at large. Specifically, and I thought it was worth talking about it because this is a recent development. And as I note here, number one, for years when there have been disasters around the world, so Israel has offered its services, its field hospital to help countries recover. This past year, the UN, for all its, it doesn't always have positive things to say about Israel, it recognized and awarded the IDF hospital as the world's best. And that was, I gave you here, this is from the IDF blog, recognized worldwide as a leader in field medicine and disaster relief, the IDF field hospital just solidified its position by achieving the World Health Organization's first ever Type 3 rating, right? Technically, their field hospitals have three levels. Level 1 for the most rudimentary, level 2 for a slightly more developed, and level 3 for the first class in field hospitals. That's been, until now, a theoretical award. They've never given it to any field hospital. And now they've decided that level 3 goes to the IDF hospital, being defined now as the best the world has. The IDF field hospital is run by medical corps doctors, soldiers, reservists, and provide immediate high quality medical care to thousands of patients in Nepal, Haiti, the Syrian border, the Philippines, and numerous other countries following disasters, both natural and man-made. And if you want to just see, I gave you at the top a picture of it. I know you can't see. I know it's small. I gave you the link, so if you in the email you can look at the you can blow it up. But that's just a picture of it. And even if you can't make out all the tags, which I can't on this, definitely not in black and white, you see just how well developed the field hospital is. Right? It has the in the middle. Right? I mean, you can just see it has an ICU. It has on the right side. What I gave you was a chart of all the divisions that it has, and you can just see how organized it is. I can mostly make it out, right? It has the medicine ward, surgery, orthopedics, pediatrics, obstetrics and gynecology, ambulatory clinic, and auxiliary services, and within each of them they have multiple, right, rooms. Within surgery, they have their triage section, the intensive care, an operating room, a post-procedure recovery room, right, and so on and so forth. It's very, very developed. Israel's very, very proud of its field hospital. And I gave you here a quote, right, that Colonel Reservist Offer Marin, commander of the IDF Medical Corps Field Hospital, said, when we were given recognition, the president of the WHO said the world should learn from Israel how to operate in disaster areas with the right ethics. For me, representing the medical corps, it was a great privilege to hear them saying that other countries should learn from Israel and operate within the right ethical values. This is a great pride, a great honor for Israel, the IDF, and the medical corps. Now, in two, I noted that there were some within Israel who argued that the reason that Israel engages in this, among other reasons, is because it's politically expedient, right? It's a good PR for us. Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman had said that it's the most effective kind of diplomacy, right? In crafting a country's image, nothing is more effective than providing aid. However, most diplomats argued with him and said that may be true. But however, and this is the third line, the second source, diplomats insist the drive is mostly altruistic. If we're sending aid to Haiti, the Philippines, and Nepal, we're obviously not looking to reap great diplomatic benefits from these countries, which I might be allowed to describe as not superpowers, that's a nice way of putting it, said a former senior diplomat in 2015, responding to a question about Lieberman's comments. So there is this feeling within Israel that as a Jewish state, being driven by Jewish values, one of the things that we can offer to the international political landscape is to be a guide of what it means to take care of people who are in trouble, not just within our own country, but to take that which we've developed because of the needs within, domestic needs of our army, and use it to help the world, right? The Israel sees that as a fundamental value, right? Of taking our skill, taking our technological advances, taking our knowledge, taking the best that we can offer, and not just making sure that our soldiers will be taken care of in battle, but that we will offer those services to those who are suffering around the world. So I want to explore, really, is that value, right? That intuition is clearly very powerful, right? And I think many of us share it. I think, I took pride when I saw, that the UN awarded Israel this award for the field hospital. And we have this intuition that it's an amazing thing that we can do, that we can offer to the world. But I want to explore that intuition. Right? What exactly is the value that's being captured? What is that Jewish value that drives us to create something so complex, so great, and bring it to the far-flung ends of the earth every time right? Every time there is trouble. Okay, so that's what I want to start with. So where does that value come from?
Tikkun Olam.
Right, so there's this generic value we talk about called Tikkun Olam. Now, what exactly Tikkun Olam means is a bit difficult, right? It's become sort of a catch-all. Where it stems from in our prayers, L'taken Olam b'malchut Shaddai, to fix the world under the reign of heaven, right? And there clearly is sort of a spiritual background to it, meaning also to teach the world about God, about monotheism. But part of that is definitely to teach them about our values, right? And to implement those values, right? Where else? Yeah. Right. Exactly. As Maish says, right, we say right at the beginning of Pirkei Avot, right at the beginning of the ethics of the fathers, there are three pillars to the world. Right? There's Torah, there's Avodah Gemilut Chasadim, there's Torah, there's prayer and worship in the Beit HaMikdash and the temple, and there's kindness. Kindness we see is a fundamental value, as one of the things the world stands on. We have commandment after commandment that is based on kindness, right? We have famously v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, right? Love your friend, your neighbor as yourself. Though, as we'll note in just a moment, classically, who is re'echa, right? Who is your friend? It's Jews, right? Re'im tend to be right? That's a specific term. It's not sort of generic. It's a very localized term. But there is this value of loving others, and then there are specific commandments that we have, right? Not just the generic catch-all, but we have specific commandments, such as tzedakah, right? Charity. Such as lo tamid al dam re'echa, don't stand idly by when your brother's blood is being spilled. We have, even within charity, right, we use it as a general term, charity, but we have all types of expressions of charity, right? We have all type of agricultural charities, that when you finish planting your field, you leave the corner for the poor, and you give 10% to the poor, and you give 10% to the Levite who's not financially well off, and you give anything that falls while you're cutting down your fruit, while you're harvesting, anything that you leave in the field goes to the poor. We have all types of commandments that relate to this. And rabbinically, we have a series of commandments of visiting the sick and helping, right? Help, right? So we know that one of the driving values in Torah, in Judaism, is kindness. But I want to really sort of push it a little bit farther, because on the one hand, intuitively, right, we all have this intuition, Judaism is about kindness, so much of Judaism is about kindness, but it's not actually obvious that we have an obligation not just to be kind or to offer assistance when it's easy. And here what we're talking about is going even farther than that, right? We're building an entire hospital and bringing it, right? Putting it on a plane. I'm not even sure how we do it, actually. It's so big. I don't know, it's a plane, multiple planes, boat, I assume planes, right? It gets there pretty fast, right? Multiple planes, I'm assuming. I don't know how many planes it takes. And getting it there, no matter what happens, anywhere in the world, right, that already, that's a pretty high level of commitment to the world. And I want to see where exactly does that come from, because I think we can justify it and we can ground it. But I want to explore it, and I think we'll maybe learn something in the process of exactly how we contextualize the general value of kindness, of chesed. Yeah. Right, so we have many different commandments of... Right, so we definitely have many commands talking about the stranger of going, right? Now that normally talks about the stranger who enters into your midst, right? This is, right, what I find fascinating here is that I think it's true, I'll argue that it is true, that we have a Torah obligation to go out and seek this ability to help, right? This privilege to help. But when you think about it, it's not so obvious, meaning in our own personal lives, if I asked you, right, what acts of kindness do you do, right, you tend to, I mean, I don't know about everyone, right, the first things that I jump to are not necessarily, right, the once-in-a-while things that I do out for someone I don't know. I tend to think of the kindness I do in my family, in my community, right, that's what takes up most of my time. I don't spend, and I don't have a tremendous amount of extra time to go traveling, right, some people do, right, but most people don't. And yet here we feel intuitively like Israel has an obligation, right? Even if as individuals we don't think we have an obligation to go out to the far-flung ends of the earth, something tells us that as a country it's different. And that's also one of the sentiments I want to explore. Yeah. Right, so I think that's, a nicer way of saying what Avigdor Lieberman said, which is that it's, let's call it ethical diplomacy, right? Meaning, I don't know, that, but I think you're right, there is clearly something to it, right, where part of it is that we feel like if we show them, we go out of our way to show them we care, even if it's beyond what we should be obligated to do, and that's important, it shows that we're human and that we care. I think that's for sure true. Yeah.
Thank you.
Right, and that's what going to be the problem, right? What if you're helping someone who's enemy, or at least, you know, I don't know, even softer than the absolute enemy? Right, so that's one of the things, right? We use this to help Syrian refugees. Yeah? So again, that's part of the question I want to explore is does it, right? Meaning a light unto the world means that we should, right, teach others what to do. Now, I think in this case, right, we are teaching others what to do. But, you know, where does that obligation start? Where does it end? How far does it go? And that's really the question I want to explore, right? Because when you think about it, you know, to give a parable on a personal level, right? So like I said, when I think of chesed, or the chesed I do, you know, how often do I get out of Thornhill or Toronto, right? Like, you know, I help people around, but I don't like traveling, and I don't have the time to travel, right? And most people, how far have you gone to perform acts of chesed? And even if, you know, you did one of those trips to, you know, whatever, South America or Africa for a week, 2 weeks, right? How many of us, devote significant amount of time? In my family, this is always, like, brought into sharp relief, because I am not a traveler. I haven't gone very far. My mother, on the other hand, spent 3 years in the Peace Corps in Botswana. So my mother put her money where her mouth is, right? My kids still can't believe, because I haven't showed them the pictures yet. I tell them that Bubby Beth had a pet monkey. They're like, you're lying. I'm like, no, I'm not lying. She had a chimpanzee. She did. You can't do that in Thornhill. You can't do that in Staten Island. You can do it in Botswana, right? Yeah.
But helping others could be also teaching.
Helping others could be teaching. I mean, my mother's in public health, so, you know, fine. That makes sense. But you could teach. You could, right? All these are the things that we can do. But where, you know, there's an intuition that we have that this is just right. But I want to ground it. In this case, I want to ground our intuition. I want to explore the sources, but I also want to explore something that isn't obvious. And this is going to come back at the end to Moshe's point, which is, I think that in addition to learning something about why we act the way we do towards other people, I want to suggest that we're going to learn something also about what it means to be a nation. Because I don't even know if you realize, but in the conversation that we've been having so far, we didn't even sort of ask the question, how did we make a jump from the responsibilities of individuals to the responsibilities of a nation? Right? Because we sort of feel like they are translatable. But that's not actually obvious that, right, nations are right, because the way nations relate to it is totally different than individuals. What we're almost doing, and we'll come back to this, is making an argument that the way we act to other individuals, Israel as a nation, or Israel personified, has to act towards other nations. That there's a certain level at which chesed exists, not just amongst individuals, but amongst nations. Right? That chesed functions differently at that level. And that's, I think, an intuition we have, but maybe never articulated, that I want to also explore. So let's go through some of the sources. So the first source that we'll explore that explicitly tells us that our obligations of chesed, our obligations of kindness, are not just parochial, are not just amongst Jews, is a Talmudic passage in Gittin in number 3, where the Talmud says that we don't protest, right? Even though technically the agricultural charity obligations or tax obligations or whatever you want to call them are meant primarily for Jews. If non-Jewish poor people come and they take leket shichah and peah, which is all these different forms of agricultural charity, we don't protest because of the ways of peace. Mishum darkei shalom. And the rabbis taught that we support the non-Jewish poor and the Jewish poor, and visit the non-Jewish sick with the Jewish sick, and bury the non-Jewish dead with the Jewish dead, because of the ways of peace. Now, if I asked you, what do those words mean? Mishum darkei shalom, because of the ways of peace. Now, what does that phrase, if I asked you, right, not leave aside your own right? Convictions for a moment. I just ask you to interpret those words. So one possibility is, so, well, let's tease that out, right? Encourage peace meaning what? So one possibility is that Darkei Shalom is some rarefied level, right? Like, ways of peace means that this is a fundamental value, right? The world should be a peaceful world, and therefore, even though certain obligations technically only apply to Jews, there's an overriding value that permeates everything in Torah, which is bringing peace to the world, and this is an expression of that. That's one possibility. How else could you read it? Right, so that, right, or it could be a moral duty, right? Let's be a... How else could you read it? Yeah. So, and we'll come back to a verse, and which the Rambam is actually going to quote, which is that the Torah's ways are ways of peace, and maybe it's derived from there. Now, all those three suggestions all go in the direction that maybe what Darkei Shalom really means, that intuition we were all talking about, that's what Darkei Shalom means. How else could you read it? So there is another possibility. There's another phrase which appears in the Talmud, which is not Darkei Shalom, which doesn't carry with it quite as much positive resonance, which is called Mishum Eva, right? Because, or to avoid hatred, to avoid enmity. Now, Darkei Shalom, right, let's think about it, right? The case that the Talmud brings, if you are divvying out money, right, you're divvying out food in your field, and a non-Jew comes along with the Jews, don't turn him away, Mishum Darkei Shalom. So how else might you read it? That it's, Darkei Shalom isn't this rarefied, the Torah's people, it's just, like, that's a really bad policy to start turning people away at your door. Now, what would the difference be between the two of those? Right, between those two, besides for, right, yes?
So one's altruistic and one is tachlis.
Good, so one is altruistic and one is, yeah, that's a good word, tachlis, right? One is very pragmatic. What else? What's the practical implications in your life?
Self-protection.
So self-protection, and therefore what? What? How would that manifest itself in your life? What's the difference between something that you believe in as a fundamental value and something that you endorse for pragmatic reasons? What?
I think what you do when nobody's looking.
Yeah, what you do when nobody's looking, how much out of your way do you go? Right? And there really are these two voices that go through this line. So, for example, if you look at Shulchan Aruch, he doesn't say explicitly what he thinks, but he has one key phrase at the beginning that might indicate a direction, which is, it is permitted to support their poor, visit the sick, bury their dead, eulogize them, and comfort their mourners because of the ways of peace. Now, what might be implied in that word? It is permitted. What does that sound like? Right? That is pragmatic, right? Like, this is not a fundamental value, but I'm not going to stop you. If you skip for a moment to number 7, I should have put in the other order. Where this becomes clear, there are authorities who clearly felt this way. So if you look, for example, in Rav Shimon ben Aderet, the Rashba, on that passage in Gittin says, Rashi interpreted, what does it mean that you bury the dead of the non-Jews with the Jews? So Rashi said, if we find them killed with Jews. It seems from his comments that he interpreted that this is specifically with Jews, meaning that while we are still involved with other Jewish dead, like, we are there anyways, and we're burying everybody. There was, and I don't know, there's a war, there was a terrorist attack, and there's, you know, 9 Jews and 1 non-Jew, and we're burying everybody. So, in that case, obviously, you bury everybody because it just looks wrong, right? You don't leave somebody lying there. That's bad. However, if we find them by themselves, no. He said that you could read it that way. You could read this as pragmatic. Now, if this was the ethos, that it was just pragmatic, so let's translate it now to our field hospital, right? Would it make any sense for Israel, following this value, you know, pragmatic value, to go off to the ends of the earth and make the best field hospital that has never, you know, has ever been seen? I would say no, right? Meaning we could send symbolic, you know, people like everyone else does. We could have made a field hospital which was good, maybe even held up to the standards of every other field hospital in the world, right? But I wouldn't go out of my way and come up with, you know, such a great field hospital that the world has to come up with a new level of award to give to it because no one has ever seen it. Like, for pragmatism, you wouldn't go that far.
Why are you surprised?
It's Israel. But that's the point. Is I'm not surprised because that's not the only possibility. Right? You could read Darkei Shalom as that it's totally pragmatic. Right? Or if you look, for example, in 8, Mari Kourkos says this as well. He says, it seems that it all depends on the ways of peace. If it seems that there will be hatred, we support and bury them. If there won't be hate and we can avoid it, we don't support or bury them. Right? Our voices say, yeah, it's totally pragmatic. And if that was the case, then we wouldn't be going out of our way. But as I said, we all share this intuition that no, this is what we should be doing. We're proud. So where does that come from? So we'll go back to where we were in 7, right? This was the fourth line. Right, the Rashba, right? He said, you could read it this way. You could say that the ways of peace are pragmatic, that it's just a way of making sure we're not hated. But he said, but it's not clear. As, quote unquote, with the Jewish dead doesn't mean that only when you go to an attack and there's 9 Jewish bodies and 1 non-Jewish body, they don't leave the non-Jew, you know, lying there. It means just like. And so too by, that should be with 2 O's, so too by supporting the non-Jewish poor with the Jewish poor, and so to all of them. This is explicit in the Yerushalmi. In fact, the Tosefta doesn't mention Jews at all. Rather, we eulogize the non-Jewish dead because of the ways of peace and comfort the non-Jewish mourners because of the ways of peace. He said it's not only when they're present. This is something we do independently. What the Talmud is telling you is you're supposed to go and you're supposed to help non-Jews just like you would help Jews. Now, why is it? Right? Where does it come from? So as Maish noted, the key may be a verse, right? Not just generic values, there may be an actual verse that drives these words, Darkei Shalom. And that is that we describe the Torah, right, as Etz Chaim Hi L'machazikim Ba, it is a tree of life to those who hold onto it. And then we say, right, Derachei Darchei Noam, its ways are ways of pleasantness, v'chol netivotea shalom, and all of its pathways are peace, that magic word peace. And Rav Aaron Soloveitchik pointed out that Rambam, Maimonides, seems to think that that's the key to understanding this. So if you look in 5 and 6, so in 5, Rambam describes this law, and he says, it seems to me that we act with a ger toshav, which is a resident alien, without getting to exactly what that status is, with respect and kindness like a Jew, because we are commanded to keep him alive, to support him, as it says, to the ger in your gates, you shall give it, meaning the carrion, the animal not killed with ritual slaughter, to this non-Jew, and give it to him to eat. And even an idolater, the sages commanded us to visit their sick, bury their dead with the Jewish dead, support their poor among the Jewish poor for the ways of peace. As it said, and then he quotes a verse, God is good to all, and his mercy is on all his handiwork. And it says, its ways are ways of pleasantness, and his paths are paths of peace. Right? Rambam sees the key to this in this verse. And this isn't the only place that Maimonides quotes this verse. But if you turn to the next page, I'll skip through. Skip to after the ellipsis in source 6. Cruelty and arrogance are found only among idol-worshipping Gentiles. By contrast, the descendants of Abraham, our patriarch, i.e. the Jews, and the Holy One, blessed be He, granted the goodness of the Torah and commanded to observe righteous statutes and judgments, are merciful to all. And similarly, with regard to the attributes of the Holy One, blessed be He, which He commanded us to emulate, it is written, His mercy are upon all His works, and whoever shows mercy to others will have mercy shown to him, as implied in Deuteronomy, He will show you mercy and be merciful upon you and multiply you. Now, Rambam quotes the verse that why is it that we're supposed to be kind to everybody? Because his mercy are on all his works, which is the same verse he quoted just a moment ago, right? That was the first verse that he quoted in explaining why we go out of our way and help non-Jews. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik said, well, let's put two and two together. Maimonides tells you that God is right, good to all of creation, to all people. And he tells you that because of that same verse, you should be kind to everybody. You should bury their dead. You should give them charity. You should visit their sick. You should eulogize them. And the Rambam says that that is Darkei Shalom, the ways of peace. So he said, you know what Maimonides is telling you? It's not just that the reason we help, it's not pragmatic, as might have been implied by the sources we saw earlier. It's not even just about kindness. When we're kind, there's actually two things we're doing simultaneously. One is we're being nice, right? We're helping the other. But we're also doing something even more profound. Being kind doesn't just affect and improve our interpersonal relationships. What is Rambam telling you? It's powerful. Why are we kind? Because of what we call in Latin, imitatio Dei, right? Because it improves your relationship with God because you imitate him. And God is good to all. And we aren't just bound to be good to other people because as people we owe it to them. We also owe it to God to be godly. And part of being godly is being kind. As the Talmud has different ways of phrasing it. In Sotah it says, Sotah describes it in terms of action, in terms of actions, right? Ma hu mivaker cholim, God himself visits the sick. As the Torah tells us that when Abraham was ill after being circumcised, after his Brit Milah, God comes to visit. So ma hu mivaker cholim, just as God visits the sick, you have to visit the sick. Not just because you owe it to the other person, you owe it to yourself as someone who reflects godliness in this world to be godly. Ma hu menachem avelim, just as he comforts the mourners. So we comfort the mourners. In fact, how do we end a shiva? As we leave a shiva, we don't just say, you know, I'm really sorry for your loss. We should see each other at Simchas. We say, Hamakom Yenachem Etchem. We invoke God. Because part of why we're coming to comfort the person is we're doing what God does. We're comforting people. In Shabbat, the Gemara puts it differently, not just in terms of actions, but in terms of character traits. Ma hu rachum, just as God is merciful, essentially. Af ata heye rachum, so you too should be merciful. Ma hu chanun, as he is gracious. Af ata heye chanun, you should be gracious. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik said that the Rambam is telling you something amazing. It's not just, as we all said, you should be kind because it supports the world, right? Ashlosha dvarim alam olmei, the three things support the world, one of them is kindness. It's not just because we have generic commandments to give charity, to help the ill. It's because part of our job as Jews is to be godly. And to be godly is to care. To be godly is to help. God goes out of his way to help people, to help animals. He created the world. And if, what? And we're made in the image of God, right? That's where it comes from. The reason that there's a commandment of the halachdra v'drachav, follow the ways of God, emulate, imitate, is because we are similar, right? Your kids, the first thing they do as they're growing up, they want to imitate their parents because, right? Okay. I hope that's a good thing. I hope it's a good thing. Because, right? You know, not they don't just want to imitate everybody. They want to imitate their parents, right? Their parents see themselves in their kids. Their kids see, I guess, themselves in their parents. And they want to be like their parents. They want to be like that which they look up to and they already identify with. Yeah?
Can you
So like I said, for the Talmud, it's the examples it gives is Rachum Chanun, right, merciful and gracious in one place, and visiting the sick, comforting the mourner, comforting the mourner, dressing the naked, right? Those are the sort of concrete examples the Talmud gives. The Rambam adds to it holiness, and Mahu Kadosh, right? As you are, just as God is holy, you should be holy, whatever that means, right? But that presumably relates also to ritual law. But at least part of the story is. In the 20, meaning what? Do you want to elaborate on the question? Meaning, I'm. Oh, you mean that? I mean, it is true. It is true that when we get down to specifics and not just generalities, right? You ask, you know, any number of people, and especially Jews, right? You will get twice the number of opinions as you have people present. That's true. And I think, you know, that's true in specifics. But the Talmud sets out general principles, right? Which I think are, you know, undisputed, right? Fundamentally, I think they're undisputed, right? That it's about kindness. Now, of course, you'll have people who will argue, what does it mean to be kind? Who are your obligations of kindness to? But that's what I'm pointing out here, is that Rambam is pretty clear that the Talmud tells you that to be godly is to be kind and to perform acts of kindness, it means that to all human beings. That's what he thinks the word Darkei Shalom means. When the Torah is Kol Netivotei Shalom, it's all ways of peace, that means that in our relationship with all people, we should be kind. We should perform acts of kindness. I understand people might disagree with that. I'm just, you know, sort of fleshing out what seems to be the position of Rambam. Yeah? So that's she asked, as the context of the second passage here in Rambam is in the laws of slavery. So she asked if, you know, we take this to its logical end, so why was it that the Torah at any point endorsed or allowed, whatever you want to say, slavery? Right, so there are different ways of dealing with it. You know, I'll just note one. Nachum Rabinovich, Rabinowitz, who used to, some of you might actually remember him from when he was in Toronto. It was way before my time. But he used to be the rabbi here in Clinton Park before he moved to England and then Israel. But now he is one of the most senior rabbis in Israel in the religious Zionist community. He's 89, I think. Wrote an article called The Ways of Torah, Darka Shel Torah, in both English and Hebrew, where he notes that he thinks there are certain commandments that were in the Torah that were there as part of a historical process moving us away from problematic institutions that were a reality of the ancient world. And so he notes that while, you know, to get rid of slavery in the ancient world was virtually impossible, but the Torah starts by trying to build in protections and that weren't present in standard slavery. But he thinks that what that indicates to you is that the Torah always wanted to move away from slavery, but the Torah recognizes that human beings are human beings, and therefore, you know, it couldn't in one fell swoop get rid of all the institutions that exist in the world. It could point you in a direction and hope that as humanity developed out of those institutions that you would follow, or that it would point humanity in that direction. That's his claim with slavery, right? Is that the Torah's protections that it put into the institution of slavery were meant to tell you that this is our improvement on the status quo, with a, you know, sort of more than a wink wink, to tell you that you should start moving away from it, right? So that's his argument. The Torah never endorsed it, it just allowed it and put protections in because it, you know, it wasn't the time to eradicate it. You know, he gives other examples where he notes this. That's one possibility. You know, there are others. There are, you know, it is possible that slavery meant something totally different. And, I mean, it did, meaning slavery in many instances meant, especially Jewish slavery in the Torah, means more like indentured servitude, right? Because Jewish slavery is is more like a 6-year work contract, but it was also a ticket out of poverty for people, because one of the, right, you had to provide for the family for 6 years and then give severance pay. At the end, so it was more like a 6-year contract with a good severance package that was meant to raise the person out of poverty. So that may be part of the answer, but you're right. It is undeniable that for that dealing with the existence of slavery in the Torah is not exactly an easy thing to deal with, especially when we have our sensibilities tells us that that is a ethical flaw, and I don't know if I can fully resolve the question. But that's where I would start, What I'm saying, that's where I would, it bothers me too. I'm saying that's, I tend to go back to that article by Rabinovich to say that the Torah never, he says the same thing about, polygamy, for example, right? He said, you read the stories in the Torah, they're not exactly giving you a ringing endorsement, right? Every time it happens, it's a bit disastrous, right? Whether it be Rachel and Leah, who don't have the best of relationships over it, whether it be Chana and Penina, where they fight, where Penina tortures Chana because she doesn't have children, right? There are instances throughout. So he said, the Torah is telling you this is a bad idea, but it didn't get rid of it. It's telling you it's a bad idea and pushing you away for it and putting limitations on it, right? You can't marry people who are related to each other. You can't, all the limitations that it put, and then, comes Rabbeinu Gershom in the 10th century and says, you know what, we've now moved to a point where this isn't part of the social fabric. We can finally sort of get rid of it from our community, right? So those are examples of things which the Torah allowed but never really loved. But, the Torah believed that human beings should slowly progress rather than, to be fair, that's what Maimonides says, right, was the reason for sacrifices, right? Was that sacrifices have a taint of idolatry in them, but God couldn't say, don't have sacrifices. That was how people worshiped God. So he said, okay, bring sacrifices, but bring them to me, right? It's, all those things sort of point in that direction, that sometimes the Torah, rather than endorsing things, just, tried to wean people of them, that whether that means there will be sacrifices in, the time of the Messiah, that's, a dispute that some of the modern commentaries have, but all of them sort of go in that direction, that maybe, yes, the Torah is trying to move away from it because it's against its ethos. Yeah?
Wasn't slavery also a way of punishment instead of killing
other
nations there?
So slavery was never, not fully punishment, it was, right, meaning it was never, inflicted as a punishment. It was sort of a punishment if somebody stole and couldn't pay back, so it was a way for them to pay back. So it's not like just a punishment. It was a, it was a...
Deserve.
But not even, right? Because if you had money and could pay back, then you paid back, right? It was a... Right, meaning it was a way of paying back, which we could impose on the person if they couldn't pay back in any other way. So it had a little bit of punishment in it, but it's primarily about restitution rather than, about the punitive component of it. Okay. So coming back to this, yeah.
I'm just wondering, if you say slavery is paid back restitution, why is the Canaanite slave especially separated for allowing inclusion in slavery?
Right, so the laws of slavery as restitution are local to Jewish slaves. The institution of non-Jewish slavery is slightly different. It's not from restitution. It's a different system. So, right, I'm speaking in generalities about this, but you're right. Meaning, the parameters of Jewish slavery and non-Jewish slavery were different, and for different reasons and at different parameters to them, which is, you know, maybe a discussion we can have if we devote an entire class to slavery, but I'm not going to give it. right, Toshiner is free to take that topic from me. But you're right, meaning we would have to distinguish between different institutions and different sort of contexts. Oh, we're back to the slavery point. I was on the okay. Like I said, slavery is an issue that, you know, has to be dealt with sort of in its own context. And I'm just offering directions. I'm happy to send out some material on it, but it really is a topic that deserves, you know, its own treatment. Okay. So what we've seen so far is that perhaps we can ground this intuition that we have in not just our general commitment to kindness, but specifically the way the Rambam formulates it is that our commitment to kindness, even outside of our community, is a function of our recognition that part of why we're kind is not just because of our interpersonal relationships, but because of our relationship with God, that we're supposed to be godly, we're supposed to imitate Him, and God cares about the entire world. Rav Moshe Sofer notes that maybe we had, you know, noted before that there were some who felt that we're only supposed to help the non-Jewish poor, the non-Jewish dead, when, you know, you're giving out charity and a bunch of Jews come to you and a non-Jew also comes and you give to him, not to, you know, make it seem that you're excluding him. Rav Moshe Sofer notes that may not prove that this law is only pragmatic. Because he notes that there's, on the one hand, everything we said is true, but there is something else to think about, which is every time we talk about kindness, there's two questions you have to ask. One is who, well, more than two questions, but I'll focus on two. One is who do you have to be kind to? Like, if I had all the resources in the world, who should I go help and how should I do it? The second question is, being cognizant of the fact that I don't have infinite resources, how do I divvy up resources? So what we've dealt with so far is only explaining the question, okay, why fundamentally is it a good thing for us to be going out and helping the world? But there's a pragmatic question you have to ask, which may have driven some of the hesitation, which is, okay, even if that's a value, but every time you help one person, use resources on one person, there is a cost, right? There's a cost, right? You know, not in a cynical way. There's a cost, literally, right? You write a check, right? You have X amount of free money in your, right, in your paycheck that you designate for charity. If you choose to give it to charity X, you won't have it for charity Y, right? And unless you have an infinite amount of resources, you have to make decisions. And maybe the reason that you see some hesitation, right, Sofer argues, is not because they're saying, look, don't give poor people, non-Jewish poor people charity because we don't want to help them. The hesitation is because we need to divide up resources. So I remember there was a back and forth in the paper when I was in high school, in 10th grade. The school I went to, Rambam, was very politically active. That's what we did. That was part of the school, right? We went on rallies, we raised money. There was a lot of activism involved in our school. So after if you remember, the big tsunami in Sri Lanka in whatever it was, 2008, was it? So the school had raised money, whatever it was, $5,000, I don't remember what it was, for the tsunami, and we tended to have political connections. So we went one step more, and we actually picked up the phone, and we called the Israeli consul in New York and the Sri Lankan ambassador, and we asked them if they'd like to meet in person to when we would give over the check, as you know, just as a way of expressing that this was something we thought was important. And you know, at the time Sri Lanka didn't have the best of relationships with Israel, so we wanted to also make a statement, and that's what happened. And it made it into the papers, and it was okay, fine. Someone wrote an article in the paper lambasting the school, saying, "I understand that the Talmud says you're supposed to help the non-Jewish poor, but the Talmud also says, look at number 11, that when you lend to my nation and the poor with you, my nation and a non-Jew, and this is true for charity also, my nation comes first. A poor and a rich person, right, you have to help the poor and the rich, but still, the poor person comes first. Your poor and the poor of your city, in your family, or just your city, your poor comes first. The poor of the city and the poor of another city, the poor of your city comes first." He said, "That's very nice. But why didn't you send those $5,000 to, are there no Jewish causes? It's very nice that other people need. And I'm willing to admit that in theory that's a value." So at the time, my principal wrote an article responding. They were nice enough at the paper. This is, you know, journalistic ethics at its best. Right? They told my principal in advance that this article was going to be printed so that they would publish the two articles next to each other. Right? They didn't want it to be multiple weeks of, like, you know, back and forth. Right? Put the two perspectives down and give him a chance to respond. So he wrote, he said, "Look, I get it. Allocation of resources is important, for sure. But what does the..." He said, "Think about it logically for just a moment. The Torah itself tells you that there will always be poor people in the world. There will always be poor people, and it even says there will always be, right, there will always be Jews who are poor. That's just the reality, right? I didn't even need the Torah to tell me that, but that's the reality. There will always be poor people. And yet the Torah tells you that you should help non-Jews also." He said, "You know what that must mean? Allocation of resources is only in terms of percentages. It can't be that the way we relate to our allocation of resources is we only give to our first priority, 100%, and when we finish with our first priority, we give to the next person the list. Because what's going to happen? You're going to find one person that really needs it, and then, right, sure, you'll give money to that person, but no one else is going to get helped, right? Anybody else who needs it just slightly less is not going to be helped at all. It has to be that allocation of resources is about percentages. Not just for pragmatic reasons, because everyone needs to be helped, but also for fundamental reasons. If you want to be not just someone who happens to be helpful, but someone who is kind and is helpful, the more people you help, right, the more you're out there, the more you create a society that's giving and caring, the more godliness enters society. So it has to be that we don't only give to our second most necessary charity after we finish giving to the first. Because then you're not going to be a very giving person, right? At the beginning of the year, you'll write one check to one person with all the money that you feel like you want to give to charity that year. And the rest of the year, someone knocks on your door and you say, "Well, you didn't need it as much as that person," right? It can't be. It must be that allocation of resources means that, yes, we have priorities. We help our community first. We help our nation first. But anything that is valuable, that expresses a truth about who we are, must find expression in the real world or it's meaningless. And therefore, sure, we raise money for Jewish charities also, but right now there are people suffering in a very visual, very viscerally evocative way. If you feel something as a human being, because you're godly, then you have to do something. That doesn't mean tomorrow I won't raise $10,000 to the Jewish charity down the street. But how can you not do something? And that was his argument. It's always sort of rung true with me since then. That if we think that even if it's true that you have to be pragmatic. And yes, maybe we should devote the majority of our resources to those who need it the most and those who are in our community and help ourselves. If it's true that the reason we help the world is because that's part of being godly, you need to carve out carve out some of your commitment so that that doesn't remain in theory, that that is actualized in the real world, so you feel it, so you see it, so it's who you are, so your kids see that you actually care about people outside of the community, that that's part of being godly. If you say, in theory, I'm willing to help them, but only after I've dealt with every single person in my own community, then no one will ever see it. It won't be real. And if the Talmud tells you that even though there will always be Jewish poor, help the non-Jewish poor, it must be that part of your calculations, we can argue about percentages and proportions, but it has to be there. It has to find expression in reality. I'll end with one more thing. And this is from another teacher of mine. I get to quote two of my teachers. That was from Rabbi Zev Friedman, and this is from Rabbi Arya Klapper. I would take it one step more. Rabbi Arya Klapper wrote an article, I think 2 years ago maybe, whether it's called, Is There a Mitzvah to Prevent Genocide? Okay? I would hope the answer to that is yes. But how would you formulate it? So he suggests as follows. He said, there is a commandment, number 12, right? Do not stand idly by the blood of your neighbor, I am God. Now, on the human plane, what that means is if you're standing somewhere and someone is dying and you can help them, you have to help them. But the question that Ray Clapper really wanted to deal with is, okay, let's move to the allocation of resources question, right? Why is it that we feel that countries have a moral responsibility to stop genocide when we don't feel that same intuition to say that every country in the world should forget about its own citizens and just go out into the world and find, you know, dying people and help them? I mean, we feel somehow like genocide is different, right? Or mass casualties in this case are different. But let's be honest, right? If we really thought we have equal responsibilities to the whole world, so, you know, if America, Canada are relatively affluent and therefore our poor aren't nearly as destitute as the poor in, you know, some third world country, so we should say, you know what, our ethical responsibility is not to help our own poor because relative to poor in, I don't know, Congo, they're not poor. We should take all that money instead of investing it into our healthcare system or into our welfare system, we should just send it as aid, without getting to the question of whether foreign aid helps, which is a different pragmatic consideration, right? Why don't we feel the same ethical compulsion to do that? So what he suggested is, I think, interesting, which is it's clear that in terms of the allocation of resources, you have to care about yourself first and allocate less resources to people outside of your community. But there are certain things that on a national plane are the equivalent of what on a personal plane is lotamid al dam reyecha. Certain moments that are so sort of complete that they demand a response. And he said, nations are sort of like people, right? I don't run over every time my friend, you know, stubs his toe. I don't need to be the one to run and find him a Band-Aid. But if he's dying there, I got to help him, right? He suggests that nations function the same way, that nations have to deal with themselves first. But when there's something which is the equivalent of lotamid al dam reyecha, that the other person is dying, there's something national, there's something global going on, nations, just like people, have to at some point say, I need to step outside of myself. Certain moments demand nations to act to other nations like people would act to people and say, I'm moving out of myself and I'm going to devote my resources that could be used for me to someone who needs it more. And he says that's why nations have to stop genocide, because genocide is like that, is where an entire nation is being killed. So that's like, right, a sort of personified nation is being killed. So when other nations have to relate to that personified people the way I would relate to someone dying next to me on the street. But I think the same thing is true of disaster relief. Right? When there are these mass things, what is it that makes us feel that Israel and not wealthy Jews in, you know, North America should be the ones stepping in? Because we feel like there's a community of nations, and that just like we help our friends or our neighbors or our community members. We feel like nations should help people than their community of nations. That metaphor, we really do believe that there's a reality to it, that nations have responsibilities to each other. And I think that might be, and I haven't, you know, fleshed it out, but I think that might be part of what drives our intuition, not just that the people should be helped by Jews, but that Israel as a nation should do its part as a part of the community of nations, just like we would expect of ourselves when you take it down to a personal level. So to summarize, I think that there's what we've seen from Rambam is that part of why, you know, we really do have this intuition that we should go out and help those people who are suffering is because of our commitment to kindness and to imitating God. And therefore, even if, point two, we allocate our resources primarily to ourselves like everybody does, we can't not also allocate it to others who are suffering, because then our commitments aren't realized and therefore they're meaningless. And the third point is that especially when it's not just individual suffering, but there's a huge community that's suffering, part of what I think drives our intuition that it should be Israel that steps in as a nation and not just private individuals is that we feel, and I think correctly, that just like we have individual responsibilities, nations have to enter into the community of nations by showing that same commitment to others. And therefore, I would suggest that disaster relief is to Israel what your friend dying on the street next to you is to an individual. It's a moment which requires an ethical response, and I think that's really the ethic that was being described by that officer when he said we take pride, an ethical pride, in the fact that the IDF has gone above and beyond, because we really do feel that's part of what it means to be an Or LaGoyim, to show the world what it could mean to really have an ethical responsibility to others. Thank you for coming to this series.